The next matter on calendar this afternoon is Meyer versus State, case number 71832. Counsel for appellant Richard Cornell is at the podium, and I assume you're ready to proceed.
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
Please reserve whatever time you want for rebuttal.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, as your record will reflect, I did not write the brief in this case. I forgot the briefs. I've read the appendix or the portions to me of the appendix. And it's always problematic when you agree to leap in to help a colleague because you read the brief and you realize you would have argued it a little bit differently. And that's what I'm going to try to do, but stick to the issue that they raised, or that was raised. In my opinion, with respect to issue number one, the insurmountable problem with Nurse Diana Emerson's testimony ultimately is relevance, meaning not 48015, but 48035. Was it helpful to the jury? And that, in turn, depends on how this court interprets NRS 200.481 sub 1 sub H, meaning what are the words in a manner that creates a risk of death or substantial bodily harm actually mean? And the problem in this case is that there was the charge of battery by strangulation, also battery by substantial causing substantial bodily harm, and the evidence of substantial bodily harm to the victim, quite frankly, is overwhelming. This appeal does not controvert the testimony, the conviction of NRS 200.481 sub 2 sub B, and there's no way that it could. There's no question that the victim suffered broken ribs and suffered a closed head injury, and that, in my book, is substantial bodily harm within the meaning of NRS 0.060, particularly as interpreted by this court in the Collins case. But that fact also creates the problem involved with this issue. When you read Nurse Emerson's in limine testimony, particularly at pages 148 and 197 of the appendix, she appears, in my view, to conflate those bodily injuries, the broken ribs, the closed head injury, the injury to the lung, with the injuries from the strangulation. And she isn't asked and doesn't really answer the key question, which is, did the injuries caused by the strangulation itself, without regard to the substantial bodily injuries otherwise, did those injuries create a risk of death or substantial bodily harm at the in limine hearing? Now, she did do that at trial, but when you read the trial testimony, I see a couple of other problems. At 718 and 725, of the appendix, Nurse Emerson's testimony is that any sort of compression on the carotid artery or the jugular vein will cause brain injuries and will have substantial medical risks and impart a risk of death or substantial bodily harm. And the problem I have with that is that what she's doing there is she's using proof of one element to create a conclusive proof of a second element of the definition of strangulation. Now, we know you can't do that by way of a jury instruction. You can't have a conclusive proof of element two by virtue of proof of element one. That's well set forth in the law from Sandstrom versus Montana and Francis versus Franklin and that line of cases. And I would submit there's no practical difference between a jury instruction who does that and a state's expert witness who does that. The second problem that I see here is that when you read the trial testimony, particularly at pages 732, 734, and 737, 738, what Nurse Emerson is saying is that the victim's substantial bodily harm impeded her ability to be adequately oxygenated and therefore increased the risk of death. Well, that gets back to a basic problem with the statutory definition. The statute simply says a risk of death or substantial bodily harm. A risk to me, in the normal, ordinary use of the word, means possibility. How do you prove a possibility beyond reasonable doubt? This is a criminal case, of course, and it seems to me that it's logically inconsistent. We can't base convictions on possibilities. There's certainly a long line of cases that say that. Frutiger and State v. Teeter, too, that come to mind, and In re Winship from the U.S. Supreme Court, each and every element has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. How do you have proof of an element of possibility proven beyond a reasonable doubt? I would submit to you for your consideration that what the statute should be interpreted to mean is a substantial risk without regard to any other injuries not caused by strangulation. And accordingly, if Nurse Emerson is asked the question, Nurse Emerson, from your review of this record, can you say to a reasonable degree of medical probability that there was a substantial risk of substantial bodily harm or death caused by the strangulation in this case, how would she answer that question? We know she wasn't asked that question. The problem that I see is we have the testimony of the ER doctor, Dr. Nielsen, which would rebut that. He did not see a substantial risk of bodily harm or death as a result of the patient, this victim, that he saw pretty close in time after the injury. So I would submit to you it was error to allow her to testify, and because of Dr. Nielsen's testimony, the error is not harmless. Moving to the second issue, I would submit this to you. The state believes that this is time to overrule Wright v. State and its progeny, particularly Garcia v. State. I strongly disagree. Wright v. State was authored in 1978 by one of the greatest justices in this court's history, in my opinion, that being Justice Gordon Thompson. And what he was doing was he was basing the ruling, and he and the court that agreed, was basing the ruling based on case law at the time out of California and New York in his interpretation of NRS 200.310. How do we interpret kidnapping when the defendant is charged with another offense that involves some degree of restraint or movement? Now, since that time, speaking of movement, I've simply not seen any movement anywhere in this court or in California or New York or anywhere else that's brought to my attention to overrule that case. And the Jackson case, with which the court's, of course, very familiar from 2012, specifically saves Wright from the element analysis of Blockberger, and I see that at 128 Nevada 612 and 13.
Mr. Cornell, so, yes. Could I interrupt you on this particular point?
Yes.
I follow your argument with respect to Wright and Garcia and Jackson, and I think you're right. Jackson did specifically reserve that area of jurisprudence. What bothers me in reading all of these cases again is Jefferson. How did we get to equating robbery and kidnapping to now talking about false imprisonment in Jefferson and robbery or attempted robbery? I mean, if it weren't for Jefferson, I'm not sure we would be having this conversation. I just don't understand why we're equating false imprisonment and the rationale in Wright and Garcia talking about the legislative intent in the kidnapping statute, and then comparing that with false imprisonment, to which Jefferson offers no legislative intent evaluation or analysis at all.
I'm wondering
if Jefferson shouldn't be overruled, I guess, is the ultimate question.
I guess my answer to that is I have struggled with that very question for years. What functionally is the difference between first-degree kidnapping, second-degree kidnapping, false imprisonment, and coercion? Oftentimes, it seems like when you're talking about restraint itself, they're covered under all of the statutes, and yet we're told, I forget the name of the case now, but we're told that false imprisonment is a lesser included of kidnapping. So I agree with you. I submit that if indeed false imprisonment is a lesser included of kidnapping, which I think it is, that the Justice Thompson's observations in Wright should apply to false imprisonment. I think Garcia should stand. I guess that's the best way I can answer the question for you. But factually, here's what I see as a problem, because the state says even if you disagree with us legally, you must agree factually, because in this case, he pulled her hair and he pinned her down, and those could be viewed as restraint without regard to the strangulation. Here's the problem I have. The jury had to find each element of this offense beyond a reasonable doubt. Pulling one by her hair is a battery, of course. Mounting one and holding them down with the hands on the neck is also a battery. And a point that wasn't really addressed in the briefs, but is so, is that Sam Meyer did testify. His defense was that she had an accident on her own that he didn't witness. And then when she came to, they had this big struggle and fight, and he acted in self-defense. Well, the jury didn't buy his story, but he did say that during the struggle, he did two things. He pulled her hair and he pinned her down. The jury could have decided the elements of battery were met by that version alone, and that his version didn't constitute self-defense. And that, and as I said before, she suffered substantial bodily harm undisputedly. They still could have conflated battery and false imprisonment. So for that reason, I would submit for the rationale for Wright and Garcia.
What do you say about Justice Mopsin's observation, though, in Mendoza, where he says that he specifically referenced the excessive use of force, substantial bodily harm, as an example where there would be separate crimes committed for kidnapping in that case?
Well, again, if factually, if the facts of the case involve movement or restraint over and above what's necessary to complete the battery, as I believe was the case in Mendoza, then that is the correct result. And that's essentially what Justice Thompson said in Wright. In this case, looking at this record and looking at what was charged, I question whether that is actually the case, and I would submit it is not. So I would submit that Wright and Garcia should apply. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices of the Supreme Court. I'm Terry McCarthy, Deputy DA from Washoe County on behalf of the state. And I think I'll do it backwards. On the subject of false imprisonment, one, these crimes were temporally distinct. They were geographically distinct. They were distinct in every way you can think of. The false imprisonment involves a woman trying to leave the scene of the crime, and a fellow reaches up and grabs her by the hair and pulls her back in.
This was after the battery. You're saying this is the... So there was sufficient evidence in your mind for the jury to conclude there was false imprisonment.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that there was also... There were many crimes committed that weren't separately charged, but they certainly could have been. But these ones that were separately charged were sufficiently distinct in the evidence and in the instructions and every other way we can think of. So now the jury can reach this under any theory that we have. Now, having said that, let's talk about what ought to apply here on the subject of double jeopardy. Because that's what Wright and its progeny really involves, is the attempt to avoid a double jeopardy problem by saying, well, the legislature couldn't have intended double punishment for a crime that happens to be two things at once, robbery and kidnapping and things like that. That approach was wrong. And I agree, I understand about Jackson reserving that. I was involved in that case as well. But it's time to rethink that, because the reasoning no longer should stand. That is, we now know, based on Jackson and in the U.S. Supreme Court decisions on jeopardy, that when the legislature enacts two crimes, two criminal statutes that can be committed at the same time with the same act, then the double jeopardy does not prohibit conviction for both in a single trial. I'll give you this. I think you ought to instruct sentencing courts, to strongly consider what to do about that. To consider concurrent sentences. But the conviction itself should stand. I think that this proposition that we should add elements to a crime, judicially add elements to a criminal statute in order to avoid a double jeopardy problem based on a legislative intent that we cannot really discern, that's the wrong approach. We've been doing it wrong for quite a long while. I think the proper approach is to look at the elements of the crime. Unanswered in Jackson. was whether we look at the elements as charged or the elements in the abstract in the statute. I don't think it matters in this case, but we ought to look solely at the elements of the offense. And if it's possible for someone to commit one without committing the other, and they happen to commit both, then they can be convicted of both. And we should stop adding elements.
So, Mr. McCarthy, Wright's been on the books for 40 years. Under our jurisprudence for stare decisis, how would we write an opinion that discards Wright, Garcia, Jefferson, and all of that reasoning, although I have some questions about whether it extends to Jefferson. But in any event, Mendoza...
I would start with Dixon versus United States, when the Supreme Court rejected the same evidence test and went back to the Blockberger test. And then this court followed up in, I can never remember the names of the two consolidated cases, one of Jackson and Garcia.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this court followed up in Jackson and Garcia and said, you're right, that's the wrong approach. And in that Jackson and Garcia, the court overruled what may have been scores of cases, starting with, you know, all discussing the gravamen of the offense. And the court then looked to what was the source of that and decided that source was wrong. I recommend doing the same thing. It's the next logical step from Jackson and Garcia. And I know we didn't take that step then, but we ought to now. It's certainly an appropriate consideration for sentencing. But we shouldn't be grafting elements onto a criminal statute that the legislature did not enact. Okay, moving right along then. I don't see any problem at all with this expert witness's testimony establishing strangulation. She was supporting, she was giving evidence that the testimony is corroborated. The victim testified about being strangled. And this witness said, yeah, well, when you strangle to the point where your bowels, you lose control of your bowels, you're getting darn close there. And that is what strangulation involves, increasing the risk of death.
Well, Mr. McCarthy, I think Mr. Cornell, at the beginning of his argument, brought up NRS 48.035, so probative value versus prejudice. Why do you feel the court didn't abuse its discretion in admitting this evidence as being more probative than prejudicial from this particular witness here?
Strangulation is an element of the offense, okay, of one of the offenses, and we're only probative, and it corroborated the testimony that was attacked by the defense and explained that you don't just lose your bowels all by your lonesome.
So your position is Judge Saller didn't abuse his discretion in as far as that statute's concerned?
Absolutely. It's a well-reasoned decision, and that, I think, is the crux of the abuse of discretion standard. It's not a de novo review. It's asking, did the trial court approach it correctly? Is the process correct? If you have reason to believe that Judge Sattler flipped the coin, go ahead, reverse it, because that's arbitrary and whimsical.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't. He had a well-reasoned decision. He examined what it was for, what was going to be presented, and decided it would be helpful to the jury, and it was relevant. And this court ought to affirm that decision and the judgment as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And, once again, I ran out of things to say. So.
Okay.
If the court has no more questions for me, I'll sit down.
Very well, thank you. Mr. Cornell, you have 3.5 minutes.
Thank you. I'll submit the first issue on the brief. Frankly, unless you have questions, I think I've covered my waterfront on that one. Second issue, you know, the problem with a case like this where there's so many blows thrown, it's almost like you want to take a snapshot of each event as it's described and say, okay, which one is the battery that we're talking about and which one is the false imprisonment that we're talking about? And had there been clarity in that way so that we know that the jury relied on incidences that couldn't have been the false imprisonment, this issue would be a loser. The problem is, when you look at the amended information at appendix page 253, it doesn't specify which act the state is alleging is the false imprisonment versus the battery.
Mr. McCarty, I think you said when your client allegedly grabbed the victim's hair and pulled her back and pinned her down, that was separate from the battery. That was a separate contract.
Right, and that's what the trial prosecutor ultimately argued at 9:30 and 9:32. But when he is pinning her down, that's when, as I understand the record anyway, that's when he's applying pressure to the carotid artery and or jugular vein and creating the strangulation. But again, I don't want to undercut what I just said. The state has to prove a battery beyond a reasonable doubt to get the conviction on counts 1 and 2. Which blow did they prove beyond a reasonable doubt? It's unfortunate. All we know is the jury found them guilty as charged. So with that, I'll submit it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cornell.
And I want to say publicly congratulations to my colleague, Mr. McCarthy, on his soon retirement. We've been doing battle for many years, and it's always been a pleasure to do so.
Congratulations, Mr. McCarthy. Did you have a question of Mr. Cornell?
I think he answered the question I had.
Very well. This matter will stand submitted.
Just do it. They're here.